I wanted to make a correction to what I said earlier. I think when I was describing filters for X-rays, I mentioned the filter could be made of aluminum, molybdenum, tungsten, and I think I also said wood, which is not correct. Wood is used in grids, in between the grids, but not in filtering of X-rays at the source. In the notes I have said, filters are typically made of tungsten and molybdenum. There could be aluminum, copper, other metals, but not wood. So make the, if you made a note of that, please make a correction. Okay, let's take up a particular application of X-ray imaging known as mammography, which is X-ray imaging of the breast for the detection of breast cancer and other diseases affecting the breast. Now, cancer in particular is the term used to indicate a type of metastatic disease where a single cell or a group of cells grows beyond the normal controlled growth. So the regular controls that apply to regulate the growth of cells doesn't apply here. These cells escape from that control and begin to multiply and spread, which is known as the process of metastasis. The resulting additional tissue area or volume is known as a mass or a tumor or a neoplasm. And the density characteristics of this region or such a region could be different eventually because of the rapidly growing characteristics of that group of tissue and also the additional blood vessels that are formed in order to supply nutrients to such a group of tissue or such a group of cells. Now, there are some diseases that cause masses that could be benign, that is, not cancerous. The term benign doesn't mean normal. It is a disease that is causing a mass, that is an abnormal growth, but it is not a metastatic form that is cancer. A benign mass is restricted in growth to a volume that is typically enclosed by a smooth boundary, but not always. Now, tumors that are malignant are related to cancer, and the abnormal growth of the cancerous mass or tumor affects the surrounding tissues and the cancer spreads. And the structure of the neighboring tissues is affected due to the expansion of the tumor and also due to the way the tumor interacts with the surrounding tissues, either pulling them or pushing them out. So benign disease could also lead to complications. But malignant tumors are of more interest because they're related to cancer and they could spread if not treated or removed early. And that could be serious if the cancer, or the situation could be serious if the cancer spreads to other parts of the body. There is a distinction between palpable cancer and non-palpable cancer, especially in breast.
Where you have a combination of gland fibrous tissue, and also the vessels, the ducts, the blood vessels, and so on. But there is an oriented texture present in mammograms because the ducts converge towards the nipple to bring the milk to the nipple. And along with this structure, there is supporting structure in the form of lipids, which will also contribute to the oriented texture. When there is a tumor, this texture is disturbed, and a departure from the normal texture is used to detect patterns that would be related to benign disease or to cancer. In mammography, a specialized X-ray source is used, where you have the target, the cathode is somewhere there, the electrons are accelerated, they hit the anode or a target, so this is the focal spot. From there you have X-rays emanating. You have a filter, which, as I said just now, corrected, is tungsten or molybdenum, typically. And then there is a collimating diaphragm, it's called a collimator there. I'll show you the other collimator later on, where it is simply an aperture with like a metallic shield that encompasses the X-ray tube. And there's an aperture here that allows X-rays only to come out from there. That's all the collimator does here. The X-rays of the beam is formed in this manner, a diverging beam, so it is not a parallel beam as we assume in the case of chest imaging, where the tube is at a distance and then it is assumed that the rays are parallel, which is not completely correct, but that's an assumption. A plexiglass or plastic paddle is used to compress the breast and to spread the tissue and make the tissue as even as possible. There are two views obtained, with the breast compressed from the top to the bottom, called the cranial front view. The cranium being the head, and the bottom being the top, or then the tail, but the bottom end, so top to bottom. And the second view is obtained in standard mammography using what is called medio-lateral oblique view. Medio from the middle, lateral to the side, and oblique at an angle. So the breast is compressed in a different way. Compression of the breast is done in order to spread the breast tissue and to make the thickness as uniform as possible over the field of imaging, so that you can use an intermediate strength or penetrating power of the X-rays. Without compression, you would have a large thickness in some parts of the breast and almost no thickness towards the end or towards the nipple, and it would be hard to use the same penetrating power of X-rays to obtain good image quality at all levels of the breast. With compression, it is possible to achieve better image quality using a certain penetrating power of the X-rays. Depends upon the breast size and density and so on. Now, after the X-rays pass through the breast, you have a detector here which I have marked as a screen film cassette in film mammography. So you have a screen that converts the X-rays to light photons, and then you have a film that will capture the light image. Before that, you have a focused grid. Now, this grid is has a different format from what I described earlier. This is a focused grid, whereas the grid I described earlier was shown to have parallel strips of metal. Here, the strips of metal are not parallel, but are arranged to agree with the diverging rays of X-rays. So you have patterns that align with the rays for different depths. So here they are nearly vertical, and here they are triangular. There are also other patterns for the grid, where instead of using sheets or plates of metal, you would use honeycomb patterns, and these patterns are arranged in a certain grid, and they are moved so that you don't get an impression of the grid on the image, on the mammogram. Okay. So the projection mechanism and the imaging mechanism is different from the regular chest X-ray imaging or X-ray imaging of the extremities. that cranial caudal view, the top to bottom view of the breast. And this is the medial lateral oblique view, which is from the middle to the side. And in the medial lateral oblique view, you also see the pectoral muscle, which is the chest muscle. And this muscle is expected to extend beyond the point where the nipple is seen, beyond 50% or 60% of the height of the image. So that if any part, if the lymph nodes here are affected, they can also be seen in the mammogram. So breast tissue close to the chest wall needs to be captured in the mammogram. The oriented texture I mentioned is seen here, and this pattern generally converges towards the nipple. And there is some disturbance here, but I'll show you examples of tumors later on. There are a few different important signs of cancer and other breast disease, and they include calcifications that are deposits of calcium in the breast. Could be within the ducts or could be within masses and tumors. Masses themselves, which could be either due to benign disease or due to cancer. Localized increase in density of the fibroglandular tissue, which could cause asymmetry between the left and right breast images. The mammograms of the left and right breast of a woman are expected to be similar, but not identical. If there are large differences and localized increase in density in one breast as compared to the other, and you don't see a similar pattern in the same area in the other breast, then that is called asymmetry. And bilateral asymmetry is an indicator that something is wrong. And a subtle sign of early stages of cancer is known as architectural distortion, where the breast tissue could be distorted without the presence of a tumor. So these are some signs of breast cancer. And there are examples in the book, and we will see some of them later on as we take some examples of image processing. I will not go into tomography in detail. There is a separate chapter on reconstruction from projections, which we will not be able to get into in this course. But I'll mention briefly the technique of tomographic imaging. The problem of interest here is visualizing the details of the interior of the human body or other objects in a non-invasive and non-destructive manner. As I explained earlier, the projection X-ray image that is obtained is an integral of the attenuation coefficients of all parts of the body in 3D onto a two-dimensional plane. For that reason, the projection image or the X-ray image that is obtained is also called a planar image. Now, what is of interest in tomography is the reconstruction of an image of only one plane within the body. There are some techniques where you obtain various planes, but in computer tomography, you typically obtain a cross-sectional plane. In classical tomography, which existed before computer tomography came up, a different type of projection is obtained. And this is known as laminography, planography, or classical tomography. And in classical tomography, which is a kind of analog film-based technique, there is a synchronous movement of the X-ray source and the film in such a way that there is only one plane that remains in focus, and all other planes of the three-dimensional body are smeared and projected onto different parts of the film. The smearing of information from other planes will lead to some loss of contrast and loss of quality, because the X-ray photons for the other planes will still affect the film. There's only one film that is used. In classical tomography, the patient lies on a table like this. There is an X-ray tube here. The X-ray tube moves in a certain pattern. In the simplest pattern, the X-ray source, the tube, moves in a straight line like that, over a few milliseconds to a couple of seconds. At the same time, the film is in a cassette below the patient, below the table, moves from here to there. So there is a synchronized movement of the film in one direction and the tube in the other direction. So what you can see is at this position, depending upon the geometry of the imaging, there is one particular plane that will cast a shadow on this film, such that as the source moves to another position, only that plane remains in focus, and all other planes, the images of all other planes in the body are smeared across the film. So consider this plane AB. At this position of the tube, a point A will cast its shadow at point A1 on the film. At the other position, the point A casts a shadow at point A2 on the film, but A1 and A2 on the film are the same point on the film. Similarly, B casts a shadow at B1 here, and for the second position, B casts a shadow at B2, and they are the same position on the film. So the plane AB will remain in focus on the film. Whereas if you consider a different plane C, or a different point in a different plane C, that point for the first position will cast a shadow of C1, and for the second position will cast a shadow of C2, and C1 and C2 are different points on the film, so they do not contribute in a synchronized manner rather than additive manner at the same point on the film. So the image of the plane for which I'm showing the point C is present on the film for all positions, but then it is smeared. Whereas for all points on the plane AB, the image will be in focus always, so that plane remains constructively added, whereas all other planes are smeared. This results in an image that looks like, for example, this image, where this is a section, but it's a longitudinal planar section through the lungs and through the, I'm not sure if it is the esophagus or the airway, but you can see that. Is that useful? Well, before computer tomography, this was considered to be useful. And this was better than just one planar projection image like the posterior and anterior image I showed. And of course, you can get different planes of this type at different levels of different positions within the body by adjusting the imaging geometry. So this was considered to be an advancement over planar projection imaging. But later on, computer tomography came up. In the 1970s, computer tomography imaging systems, or CT imaging systems, were developed. The mathematical techniques underlying computer tomography were developed earlier in the late 1960s. And the techniques were developed in different areas, including radio astronomy and reconstruction from projections, and just the mathematical principles of representation of images using intervals. But all of them were put together in the 1970s to achieve cross-sectional imaging of the human body in a non-destructive manner. In CT imaging, that is computer tomography imaging, only the desired cross-sectional plane is irradiated. Or if you want multiple planes, you irradiate one plane at a time in the original and classical style of computer tomography. Now, even computer tomography has advanced and changed, so you can refer to earlier versions of CT scanning as classical, although the word classical is applied to the linear form of film-based tomography. So in the simplest form of tomography, let me put it that way, or what is also called the first generation CT imaging systems, only one plane is irradiated at a time using a fine ray of X-rays, such as this laser beam. So you send one ray. The word ray and beam have been used interchangeably, whereas really, if I say beam, it would be a three-dimensional beam of X-rays, And if I say ray, it is one ray which is along one straight line. It is also called a single pencil of X-rays. There is a small distinction there, but the word beam is used in general. In CT imaging, one ray at a time is sent through the body in the simplest way of CT imaging. And ray intervals are measured at many positions and angles around the body for the plane of interest, the cross-sectional plane of interest. And the principle of image reconstruction from projections is applied. And this is something we will not be able to discuss in this course. There is a separate chapter in my book on that topic if you are interested. So from the ray intervals, you compute the cross-sectional image, and hence it is called computed tomography. There are a few other words used, computer-aided or computer-assisted or computer-axial tomography and so on, but the standard phrase is computed tomography for CT. So using the same image that I showed earlier, where the entire volume was irradiated with several X-rays, or several rays of the X-ray photons, here you only use one. You only irradiate this plane of interest. So one X-ray is passed through, you make a measurement. You make a measurement of the number of photons at the input end and at the output end over a certain counting period. And then move the source to another position in the same plane, send another ray and make a measurement, another ray and so on. If you do such measurements for a given position, and a given angle, and put all these rays together, and the rays are mutually parallel, then you obtain what is called one projection. But this is the projection, not of the entire body, but only of one plane. So the two-dimensional plane PQRS is now integrated onto one one-dimensional projection, written here as E prime, Q prime. And then you either rotate the object or rotate the X-ray tube and detector gantry to another angle and repeat the process. And you obtain such projections for a number of angles all the way around the body, and then combine the data using techniques for image reconstruction from projection. There are different mechanisms of scanning a body. Here a body is shown in cross-section. In what is called the first generation CT scanner, there's only one X-ray source and one detector. And the detector would have a collimator, and the source would also have a collimator. So the source would send only one fine and narrow ray of X-rays, and the detector would accept rays only coming along that one particular line. So you have one X-ray source and one detector. You fire one ray, make a measurement, then translate or move the X-ray source and the detector, they are linked physically one step, and take a number of measurements to span the object. Then you rotate and do the same thing. If the object is an inanimate object or a lab animal that is constrained, then you may also be able to rotate the sample and hold the X-ray tube and detector fixed. But for human beings, you would not hold a human being. You will not rotate a human being, but rotate the gantry. In the second generation, as more detectors could be put together and the mechanism to use detectors improved, a small detector array was used, and instead of getting parallel projections like this, parallel rays, a fan was used, where depending upon the number of detectors in the array, you would have a certain fan angle, and you would send X-rays not only in one line at a time, but in a fan, but in the same plane. So you could make a number of measurements at the same time, and the number of translation steps taken would be reduced, but still you have to run around at different angles along the object to obtain a number of projections at different angles. And these data would be rebuilt so that you tip all the rays at the same angle from different projections together and regroup them so they would appear to be like this. And then the same algorithm could be used. as for parallel rays. So these two were called translate rotate scanners because the gantry that was holding the X-ray tube and the detector had to be translated from one position to another for the same angle and also rotated. Later on, in the third generation, the translation step was removed by using a larger array of detectors, and they were arranged in this manner, in a semicircular, or not semicircular, but in an arc, let's say. And then the gantry to the source and the array combined would only rotate. So the scanner could acquire the data faster. And then later on, the source and the detector were decoupled, and many detectors were arranged in a ring, all the way around, fixed in the scanner, and only the X-ray tube had to run around. And here, you use a wider fan, and again, you could use the fan beam data directly in fan beam reconstruction algorithms, or regroup or rebin the data into parallel ray data like that, like in the first generation. Nowadays, we have something beyond this, where multiple planes may be acquired. Data for multiple planes may be acquired at the same time by using a wider fan spanning different slices and using multiple rings of detectors. Or there is also a technique known as spiral CT, where the tube runs in. The tube runs around and the patient is also moved at the same time, so that effectively you are scanning the body not in parallel planes but in a spiral manner. And all of this is done in order to acquire the data faster and faster so that you can minimize artifacts due to motion of the patient or movement of various parts of the body or movement of gas in the bowels and so on. There is an interesting system that was developed for cardiovascular imaging where movement was completely eliminated in the scanning process of the X-ray tube and the source and the detectors. So here, an electron gun is used in this position. There are focus coils, and instead of using one electron source using a single piece of, instead of using an X-ray source like the traditional X-ray source I have explained so far, with one small piece of the anode from where you get the X-rays. In this system, the anode is not one small piece of tungsten, but is a ring. Not a complete 360-degree ring, but about three-quarters of a ring. And there are several anodes like this in parallel, shown here as four rings. Now, to generate X-rays, the electron beam from the electron gun will go through some focusing coils, and they will be bent in this form to hit the anode, which is that three-quarters of a ring of metal, of the anode material. And suppose the electron beam is here, you get a fan of X-ray beam like that. And if you were to modify the focusing and bending coil data, or control signals, and hit the anode here, you would get a fan at that angle. So instead of rotating the X-ray tube, in this system, it is only the electron beam that is moved. So, movement of the X-ray tube is removed, and instead, the X-ray source is anywhere along this ring, and hence you can scan the patient at a much faster rate or in a much smaller period of time. And there are also four of these, so you can switch from one item to another and obtain multiple sectional data again through the heart in a matter of a few milliseconds. Got a question?
Yeah, when the electron's bent, does it lose any energy?
There would be loss of energy, yes.
So,
but
So, like, aren't any X-rays produced when it's bent?
Well, I don't know. I haven't heard of that. This article I read doesn't mention that. That is done in a synchrotron. In a synchrotron, you get the radiation, the light, as it was called, by bending. But that's at a much higher electron current. I'm not sure if any X-rays would be emitted here due to the bending. And if they are emitted, I suppose they are not, because that is not what is of interest. What is of interest is the X-rays emitted using the standard Bremsstrahlung radiation, where the electron beam hits the anode target here. So this is a traditional X-ray tube, but much, much bigger.
I was just wondering if it would create any artifacts.
I suppose if any radiation is produced here due to bending, that would be blocked. But the article I have read doesn't mention anything of that nature. So at the current rate used here, I'm not sure if the bending would produce any radiation. And if it does, I'm quite sure that it would be blocking it over there. So this is an X-ray tube, like the traditional X-ray tube, but much bigger. And more complex because it's a much larger vacuum tube. Or this whole part has to be a vacuum chamber. Okay? So instead of moving the X-ray tube and the detector here, there's no movement of the X-ray tube. Now, the detector is moved or could be moved depending upon what you want to do. So here, without any movement of the detector is like this. You can obtain projections through the heart, somewhere here, for various angles. More details are available in the reference, you could read that. It's quite old now, it's about 30 years old, 1979. And some of these were built and they were used. I'm not sure if they're in current use. The interesting aspect of this system is that movement of the X-ray tube was removed. And that was the aim of these developments from the first generation CT scan to the fourth, to reduce movement so data could be acquired faster and faster. The first generation took several minutes and was used for only to image the brain, where the head could be clamped and held motionless for several minutes. Whereas the rest of the body, it would be hard to hold still for several minutes. And then with the third and fourth generation scanners, the scan time in per slice was reduced to the order of a fraction of a second. And it was possible to apply to other parts of the body. So that's what a cross-sectional layer of the brain looks like, the skull here and the brain, with the ventricles and what I call the convolutions, the patterns of the brain tissue. And this is through the abdomen, different parts of the abdomen muscle, the stomach, the spinal column, the spinal canal, the kidneys, the liver, and so on. With CT images, the dynamic range is quite large. With normalization of the attenuation coefficient with respect to that of water, and multiplication by a constant of 1,000, the range of values obtained for a human body is of the order of minus 1,000 to plus 1,000, what is called Hounsfield units, after the developer of the first CT scanner, who also shared the Nobel Prize for medicine. To display such a large dynamic range of about 1 to 2,000 on a cathode ray tube monitor or any ordinary computer monitor with a limited dynamic range is difficult. What is typically done is, with the same data, you obtain multiple views by selecting a certain range of the density and spreading that range of density or transfer units to the display range. So in this display, you see the low density lung tissue expanded to a brighter range of value or mapped to the display range of the output device. Whereas here, the lower density material has been rendered as almost black or zero, and the media sample is seen in more detail. So intermediate density tissue is displayed in more detail here. Here, intermediate and high density tissue is all saturated. So for the same slice, using the same data, by using different mapping of the original data in the CT slice to map to the output device, by selecting a narrow range of constant unit values of interest, you obtain different output values on the display. So we will look into these techniques later on, but I just want to mention that in particular in computed tomography, we run into this issue where the dynamic range of the data is large, much larger than the dynamic range of ordinary display devices, such as cathode battery monitors or even LCD monitors, and also much larger than the dynamic range of the human visual system for a given level of adaptation of light. We will not be able to appreciate more than some 60 or 70 levels of gray for a given lighting level. So if you have data like this with a range of 1 to 2,000 or minus 1,000 to plus 1,000, even if you were to have a display device to show all of that information in one image, the human visual system quite likely would not be able to interpret that information. So it is important to take small ranges of the input data and show them one range at a time.